Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, your host and CEO of Bregman Partners. This podcast is part of my mission to help you get massive traction on the things that matter most. Michael Port is here with me today. He's a New York Times best-selling author. He's written 6 books, including the one that we're talking about today, Steal the Show, From Speeches to Job Interviews to Deal Closing Pitches, How to Guarantee a Standing Ovation for All the Performances in Your Life. He is a keynote speaker. He is a go-to coach for professional speakers and CEOs around the world. His companies offer workshops, private coaching, and online courses on marketing. He knows quite a bit about showing up in a way that allows you to bring your best performance forward. And the book itself, Steal the Show, is really a great and very straightforward read about speaking out there in public in a way that brings out who you are and in a way that's also at the same time compelling to your audiences. I thought it was a terrific book. Michael, welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
So, Michael, let's get started with one thing that you say in the book originally, finding your voice, that the courage to share who you really are, not just what you want others to think you are or who you want others to think you are. That's in some ways very obvious and in other ways quite profound, and realizing how many of us show up in a way that tries to meet expectations as opposed to showing up with our authenticity. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Sure. Well, different times in our lives, we wrap ourselves up in layers of persona. And we think those layers of persona are going to serve like armor and protect us, when in fact, often it's just parchment-like armor. And it's easy for people to poke holes in it. And sometimes people are more inclined to poke holes in your armor if they feel that you're presenting yourself in a way that's not authentic. And of course, that's the irony. When you present yourself in a way that's very honest and very authentic, generally people are less interested in knocking you down. So I say, let's strip away those layers of persona and let's find out how, let's discover how we want to behave in the world so that we feel fully self-expressed and we're not expressing ourselves in response to others, in rebellious fashion to others, but expressing ourselves based on what we believe, and we're not forcing those beliefs down other people's throats. And as a result, we tend to be less worried about criticism, because most of the fear that we have around performance or presenting ourselves in a way that is larger than our sort of typical walking around our house self is based on the fact that we're afraid to get rejected. Rejection doesn't feel good. I don't like rejection. I haven't met too many people who like rejection, but it's a part of life. And if we are worried about rejection, then our fear is stronger than our desire. And until our desire is stronger than our fear, we may not show up as the kind of leader that we know we can be.
So this is, of course, the $100 million question, which is the ability to show up in that way, meaning the fear that so many leaders have is one of being vulnerable. Now, you and I can talk about this more easily, possibly, and conceptually, theoretically say, like, of course, what we know is that people connect in vulnerability. They don't actually connect in strength. They connect in vulnerability. And showing up with some vulnerability in who you are is the key to being able to convey your message in a powerful way. On the other hand, when you're the one who's about to do it, that fear of rejection and rejection when you're pretending to be someone else doesn't hurt that much because it's not you. But rejection, however much that hurts, it hurts a million times more if you get rejected and you're actually being authentically yourself, because that's sort of a deep identity rejection. How do you help people show up in that vulnerability and get over the hump that is kind of pushing them towards protecting themselves with a mask of sorts, or, you know, that kind of armor.
Yeah. It's interesting because we think that it'll hurt more if we actually go after what we want. For example, when I was an actor, that was my first career, I had a modicum of success. I was at that point where I was doing, you know, recurring roles in TV and small roles in film, and I was doing a lot of voiceover. That was my bread and butter in between gigs. And I was testing for a film called Kiss the Girls, and it was with Morgan Freeman. And I was to play opposite Morgan Freeman, his partner, his cop partner. And that character also happened to be, spoiler alert, I don't think too many people are going to be watching that film, it's an old film, but also turned out to be the serial killer. You know, I guess I look like a cop or a serial killer, either one or the other or both. And I remember reading the script and thinking, I don't know, is this going to be great? Or do I really want to be a character that is a serial killer and I want to typecast myself? Or I don't know, you know. So I talked my way out of preparing for it in a way that I needed to, because great performances require real preparation. And people like the idea of winging things because they think that they're more authentic or, you know, more spontaneous, but usually it doesn't work out so well. And I didn't get it. And I was able to say, oh, fine, I didn't really want that, you know, because it wasn't a great script, or I don't want to get typecast. But when I look back at that, I can honestly say that I was full of baloney. I think I was afraid, and this is, I think, was true for many of the roles that I was going out for. I was truly afraid that if I told others how much I wanted it, if I showed the world how much I cared, then it would hurt that much more if I didn't get it, and I'd look really stupid if I didn't. But if I didn't care about whether or not I got it, then, well, you know, I don't really look stupid because I didn't want it anyway. So, you know, fine. It's not really you who rejected me. It's me who rejected you. But of course, that was all baloney. It took me, you know, just like many things in life, it took getting older to discover what a lie that was. And in fact, now when I admit what I want and how much I want it and I don't get it, it really doesn't hurt at all, frankly, because I know that I have another chance. I know that I can keep going after what I want. And here's the other thing. I don't think other people determine my future. Whether or not someone says yes to me, it doesn't mean that I will never have that thing that I want. It just doesn't work that way.
It's so interesting, Michael, because you're pointing out something that I've completely overlooked, which is that when you are not being authentic and you don't get what you want, on the one hand, yeah, you might be able to say, well, I didn't really want it. But the truth is, you know, you held back, and you know that you possibly could have gotten it if you were more willing to put yourself out there. And that by putting yourself out there, it may hurt, but you know you've given it your all and you can move on from that. And that there's no regret, in a sense, in the way that there is when you've sort of shown up in a mask. And I really have never thought of it that way. And it feels so true.
It's exactly right. And, you know, this is something that the creative artist experiences day in and day out if they're really in pursuit of mastery around their work. And the entrepreneur is a creative artist. A creative artist is somebody who's trying to produce an experience for other people. And an entrepreneur, a leader, is trying to produce experiences for the customer that she serves and for the people that he works with. And that's his job in part. And we're playing a role while we do it. Shakespeare said, of course, people are familiar with this. He said, all the world's a stage. And many people give lip service to it, go, oh, yeah, I get that, I get that. But if you think about it, we're playing roles all the time. We play one role at the office, another role at home with our spouse, another role as a father, another role as a brother, another role with, you know, your buddies from high school, another role with your neighbor. Now, hopefully they're all authentic roles. They represent our values, who we are and what we believe, but our way of being may change slightly from role to role. People will still recognize who we are, but for example, if the drill sergeant in the Marines behaves the same way with his daughters, who are 6, 7, and 8 years old, that he does with the new recruits in boot camp, his relationships with his daughters may suffer. And vice versa. If he treats his new recruits in the Marines the way that he treats his 6, 7-year-old daughters, those Marines may not live very long in the battlefield.
Yeah, I thought it was such an interesting point you made early on in the book that playing those roles is not inauthentic, that you're emphasizing certain parts of your personality in certain situations and you're de-emphasizing others. But you offer this very expansive, complex view of who we are that offers us some freedom to be inconsistent and still consistent and still authentic.
That's exactly right. It's almost counterintuitive. In fact, what you discover is that people who are rigidly true to self, meaning they have trouble adapting, they have such a strong point of view that they have trouble seeing the world from other people's eyes, or they see themselves in one way so that they can only do certain things, well, they have trouble advancing, moving forward, taking on new responsibilities, new roles. Again, there's that word role. I mean, when you hire people, you generally hire them to play a role. Well, you're going to play the role of communications director. You're going to play the role of CFO. And, you know, you want to move into leading roles over time. But if you're so true to self, you're so rigidly fixed on an idea of who you are, it may be harder to move into those roles. But when you are open to different ways of being and open to seeing yourself as more than just one thing, then you often can feel comfortable moving in and out of different roles, moving in and out of different groups, interacting with different people from different walks of life. And I think that's kind of thrilling. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's certainly freedom enhancing, right? It allows you to see yourself more broadly than you might otherwise, and allows you to be authentic throughout the whole process.
Well, here's a really everyday life type example. So my name is Michael, and I usually introduce myself as Michael. In fact, I always introduce myself as Michael. 9 times out of 10, people who are generally in blue collar environments will immediately start calling me Mike. I'll say, "Hi, I'm Michael Port." And they go, "Hey, what's up, Mike?" And I always think, and at the beginning, when I started recognizing this, I thought, well, I just thought, didn't I just say Michael? Why are they calling me Mike? But what I discovered over time is that familiarity, that colloquial interaction is comfortable for them. And the name Mike is they're more accustomed to the name Mike than Michael. So I could roll two ways. I could say, no, my name is Michael. You must call me Michael. Or I could say, okay, great. And I could let them call me Mike, because why not? And then our relationship can develop based on that language. And language is incredibly powerful. Language influences the way we think. It influences the way other people think about us. The language we use means so much more than we often recognize. And so I know as soon as somebody calls me Mike, I know a lot more about them than they think or realize I know about them.
It requires flexibility on your part to say, I don't mind if someone calls me something that I don't think of myself as.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a negative connotation with Mike, because when I was in high school, they called me Big Mike. You know, I'm not very big now, but I was one of those man children. You know how there's one kid that he looks like he's 25 and he's 12.
Right. And,
you know, I had to bring my birth certificate to Little League games because they thought I was a ringer. I was older. So, you know, I didn't really like it. Big Mike kind of sounds like, oh, you're the dumb big kid. So I moved away from the name Mike when I went to college and I went with Michael. But I am of an age now where I don't mind that. You can call me Big Mike, you can call me Little Mike, you can call me whatever you want. It's not going to affect me because my identity is not wrapped up in something like that. Now, you might think this is a small little thing, but these kinds of things happen all day long. And if we can roll with these adaptations of our idea of who we are, we generally can move in and out of different groups. So I can hang out with those guys down from the docks who want to call me Mike, and I can hang out with the librarians who, you know, have an entirely different language and way of being.
It's great. You're bringing out an aspect of this book that I noticed so much, which is that it's a book about communication, but it's a book about so much more. It's a book about how we move through the world, and communication is the face that the world sees of us. And so the two, who we are and how we convey that, are inextricably connected.
That's exactly right.
You say something that I thought was brilliant early on in the book again, and that is, I'd like you to expand on it a little bit, that is that if you want to silence critics, stop being critical.
Yes. First of all, can I just thank you for reading the book? Because I've done, you know, hundreds of podcasts over the years, and very often the podcaster, you know, will say, so there was a concept in chapter 2 that you were talking about. Can you elaborate on that? You didn't read the book. I know.
That's funny. You know, the surprising thing is I can't tell. First of all, thank you. And it was a fantastic book. I enjoyed it. And I can't tell you how many people I interview say exactly the same thing to me once we're off air, to say, wow, you really read the book. And I think, how could you get interviewed without reading the book? So thank you for appreciating that.
We're very welcome. It's my pleasure. Yes. Yeah, so it's not hard to be critical. It really isn't. You know, my boys came home from their first day of school today, and one's 11, one's 12. And the first thing they do is start talking about the teachers. Like, oh yeah, she's like a robot. Oh yeah, did you get what's his name? Yeah, he's the worst. And I said, guys, that's not going to fly. You know that's not going to fly. Because it's just too easy to do that. First of all, they're making snap judgments. Second of all, it's disrespectful of your teachers. And that's a whole nother conversation altogether. But one of the things that holds us back from taking risks and making big choices, and of course, choices are the other things that tell the world about who we are. And then, of course, the way you communicate those choices, as you indicated. Making big choices requires taking risk, and we may be rejected. So, of course, we talked about this fear of rejection. And when someone criticizes you, you feel rejected. So there's some research, a lot of research, in fact, around rejection. And the research shows that when you are rejected, you feel physical pain first. Now, we don't recognize it as physical pain, but the center of the brain that experiences physical pain is the same part of the brain that lights up when you're emotionally rejected. So even before we know whether or not we care about the kind of rejection we got or who it was from, we immediately feel pain. And then we process it differently depending on how we see the particular type of rejection or the person that's rejecting us. So the first thing to do is to recognize that, oh, it's a natural physiological response to feel pain when somebody rejects us, even if we couldn't care less about that person. You know, so for example, if someone doesn't give you their seat on the bus, you know, and let's say you broke your leg and there's like a 16-year-old kid there who's perfectly healthy and they won't give you their seat. You feel rejected and angry at this person. But why? You don't know this person. You have no idea what's going on in their life. You shouldn't care about whether or not they rejected you. But yet we do. We feel this physical pain first, and then we start perseverating on it psychologically, and we can often go down a rabbit hole. But there's two types of rejection. There's two types of criticism, rather. Generally, there is the external critic, the person in the cheap seat who puts other people down to lift themselves up. And then there's internal criticism. They're the voices of judgment in your head, and they are both strong voices. However, the louder the voices of judgment in your head, the more you will hear the external critics. So if we want to silence the external critics, instead of trying to fight them to get them to shut up, what we need to do is work on silencing our own voices of judgment. Because when you don't criticize yourself, you are less concerned about the criticism you may get from other people. That's number one. Number two, when we criticize others, we know that that criticism is going to come back to us. Maybe not from that person, but from somewhere, because we are living a life of a critic. You can be a critic or a performer, but I don't think you can be both. You can spend your days criticizing the work of others, or you can spend your days being creative. And there are a few people who may choose, I don't want to be creative, I'm just going to criticize others. That's what I'm going to do. But I think it's pretty hard to spend your time criticizing others and then also be willing to take risks and put yourself out on the line in such a way that you may be criticized yourself. I haven't seen too many people who do that really, really well.
So how do we manage that kind of non-critical perspective with this other piece that you talk about and that's important, which is feedback, which is a gift? Criticism can knock us down. Feedback can help us get better. Where do you draw that distinction?
It depends on who it's coming from. If I'm working with a student and I give them feedback, they know I'm not criticizing them because they know I'm dedicated to serving them and they respect me and they've come to me for my feedback. That's feedback. That's not criticism. But if somebody comes up to you that you do not know and says, listen, can I give you a little constructive criticism? You just say no, because constructive criticism is still criticism, just dressed up in a pretty outfit.
It's interesting. I would imagine that it's also based in part maybe on who the person is, maybe also the energy with which it's offered. Meaning I could imagine people who don't know me coming and saying, thank you for that speech. And, you know, I had a thought of blah, 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 blah. And that if it comes from a place of caring, that comes through and that it could be useful, but maybe not. I'm curious to get your perspective.
Absolutely. So I will take feedback from people I don't know if I think that they're offering it in a way that's going to be helpful and they're doing it to help me, not to somehow serve their own needs of feeling important or better or putting somebody else down, as I said before, to lift somebody up. But we're under no obligation to take quote unquote feedback or criticism from anyone. We're under no obligation. So I think as people who are in pursuit of mastery, when we're working on something that is new material, that's sensitive, that we're unsure about, I think we should choose the people very carefully from whom we get our feedback. And when we're getting feedback, one of the things we have in our process is a way of teaching our students how to get the right feedback and how to ask for feedback. Because often, especially when you're working on, say, speeches, people will know what they like and they don't like, but they don't really know how to translate that in a way that's helpful for you necessarily, because they are not necessarily expert at teaching one how to be better in that particular area. So if you know how to ask for feedback in a way that gets you what you need to improve, that's very, very helpful. So you're in more control of that feedback loop rather than just sitting there and letting people throw whatever feedback they want at you.
I love that distinction too, which is the question of why they're giving you the feedback. Are they doing it sincerely to help you? Or are they doing it because they want to make themselves feel better or feel stronger or feel bigger or something like that? And that you could really tell that very quickly from somebody.
Yeah, I think you can. And sometimes it takes a little bit of chutzpah to say, no, thanks, I'm okay. I'm not looking for feedback right now.
I think that's a very powerful boundary to be able to share, especially for those of us that want to keep getting better at what we do, to be able to say, no, thanks, I don't actually want the feedback, is very powerful.
Also, you don't want to seem arrogant. You know, sometimes we feel this obligation to let people give us feedback.
Right.
It is this very interesting thing. Someone says, can I give you some, you know, feedback or some constructive criticism? And you're like, oh, okay, sure. Because you want to seem like the kind of person that's totally cool with that. And you're confident and no problem. And then you don't want to offend them for saying no, which I, of course, if they get offended because you say, I'm not looking for feedback right now, that's their problem, not your problem. You're a creative artist. And sometimes you need to protect your work and just get the feedback from people who help you grow. Not from people who just tell you you're great when what you're doing is not working, but people who actually help you grow.
I think that characterization as you're a creative artist is a great one for leaders in organizations to hold on to as well. That, you know, the work that we do as leaders is creative, artistic work. And to appreciate that allows you to, I think, take some risky steps that make you a more powerful leader. So I kind of want the business world to appropriate some of that language, which I think could be very useful.
Absolutely. You know, I was actually just, I was doing an interview with Eric Wall, who's a very well-known speaker and artist, a famous graffiti artist, just about 2 hours ago. And one of the things we were talking about is cross-appropriation. He hadn't used the term before, but what he was talking about is, listen, you know, to get a lot of my ideas for my speeches, I go watch concerts. I'm friends with rock stars and musicians. And, you know, I look at architecture and I look at the movie industry. And he was talking about all these places he gets ideas. He didn't say, I get my ideas from going and watching other speakers. What he is doing is cross-appropriating. He's taking ideas from one space and he's moving it into another. And in the process, creating a new world. I mean, he does things as a speaker that nobody does. And that's what you're talking about here. We cross-appropriate the language, cross-appropriate these ideas. Take a big, broad view of the world rather than just a small view of your own disclosive space. And generally, you can create over and over and over again because you're not limited by this small space in which you inhabit. That's cross-appropriation. Great entrepreneurs do that.
It's great. You talk about and you talked about it earlier in this conversation too, the importance of rehearsal. I don't know that you use the word rehearsal, but preparation is what you said, to really, you know, do the preparation. How do you balance this stiffness that can come from either rehearsing or preparing and really knowing your stuff? It kind of, I don't know if you suggest it from a rote perspective. I don't think that you do. But to really know your stuff and still feel natural and in the moment when everything's planned out. How do you walk that line?
It's fantastic. This is like a big softball question for me, because this I just want to hit over and over and over again as many times and in many places as I can. There's this idea that people have that if they rehearse, they will somehow feel stiff and be seen as inauthentic. And for many people, that's true, because they have tried some rehearsal in the past and they felt stiff and inauthentic when they presented. But the reason they felt stiff and inauthentic is because they didn't do enough rehearsal. They just did a little bit of rehearsal, because here's what happens. When you do a little bit of rehearsal, then you go and perform. While you're performing, you're trying to recall what you did in rehearsal, which takes you out of the current moment. And the performer needs to be in the moment to seem authentic and to be natural. Because if you don't know your material well enough and you have to search for it, you're not going to be able to be spontaneous. So spontaneity plus, or improvisation rather, plus preparation is what produces spontaneity. The more prepared you are, the more spontaneous you can be. Because just like the actor does, they are so well rehearsed that before they walk on stage, they can forget everything that they rehearsed. But it will come to them in the moment, authentically, as if it was happening for the first time. They have such confidence and awareness that they are in control of themselves and the space around them. It's very hard to have control of yourself in a public speaking setting without complete comfort with the material. It doesn't mean that you need to memorize everything word for word. It doesn't mean that you do every single speech the exact same way every time, but it means that you have the ability to, if you wanted to.
You know, I see this also, you see this most explicitly in some ways in dance. And when people have rehearsed in dance and they're just trying to get the moves, they've rehearsed a little bit, but they don't really own the moves yet. Everything's a little stilted and a little awkward, or at the very best, it's specific and clear, but you know, without character. And when they really know all the moves and they don't have to think about making each move, then they could do an extra flip of the wrist or a move of the hip or do something in their dance that that adds flourish and character to what they're doing, because they're not worried about whether they forget to raise an arm or move a leg. And it's like this visual example of what you're describing.
That's right. And that's where the emotional experience gets rich for the performer and for the audience. So if you're giving a speech as a leader, let's say you're giving your annual address, well, the facts and figures, you know, might mean something, although most of the company have probably already seen them on the regular memos that go around. The here's our vision for the future is, you know, probably something that they're aware of. What they're going to connect to, however, is the emotional experience that you bring to them. And it's very hard to be authentic emotionally if you are just trying to remember what the hell you were going to talk about.
Right.
So knowing your material is what allows you to feel. It's what allows you to exist in that moment and listen to what is happening around you. Here's the thing that's strange about public speaking. Public speaking, people think, is just about talking. Public speaking, in fact, is about listening just as much as it is about talking. Great actors are great listeners. Great actors are great listeners. Great public speakers are great listeners because they can listen to their audience and understand what their audience is saying, thinking, and feeling, even if their audience does not open their mouth or move their body.
It's great. Michael, there's so much more to talk about. We've run out of time, but it's such a pleasure to have you in this conversation. The book is Steal the Show, From Speeches to Job Interviews to Deal Closing Pitches, How to Guarantee a Standing Ovation for All the Performances in Your Life. Michael, this conversation in the book underscores the beauty of your perspective, which really is very counterintuitive and immediately recognizable as true. So it's, you know, it's this great combination. I've learned a lot both from reading and from having this conversation with you. Thank you so much for being on the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.